Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. At the time of recording, it's June. For Catholics, this is the month in which we celebrate the Sacred Heart of Jesus. In gratitude for his merciful heart and his love for humankind, which has brought us forgiveness and freedom. Catholics have used banners and art to depict the Sacred Heart of Jesus. One of the most beautiful to my mind was that created in response to a vision of Jesus given to a Polish nun in 1931 to Sister Helena Faustina. She wrote, "In the evening when I was in my cell, I became aware of the Lord Jesus clothed in a white garment. One hand was raised in blessing and the other was touching the garment at the breast. And from the opening of the garment at the breast, there came forth two large rays, one red and the other pale. In silence, I gazed intently at the Lord and my soul was overwhelmed with fear, but also with great joy. And after a while, Jesus said to me, 'Paint an image according to the pattern you see,' with the inscription, 'Jesus, I trust in you.'" And this very moving image of Jesus that she did paint is to be found amongst Catholics as we turn our attention to our need for God and his transforming love in our lives. It's inspirational, it has great impact and is much used in June, the month of the Sacred Heart. Because art can have a visceral impact on any bystander. All movements, religious and political, use art and image to make an impact, conveying their ambitions and their intentions. Impacting the public space with art is an ambition for all groups who have something important to share. The Pride movement thinks so too, and has been very effective in placing Pride flags throughout the public space. Nowhere more so than in Regent Street in London, where the latest version of the Pride flag marking June as Pride Month is carpeting the sky above the pavement. And the impact and scale of this ambitious movement has caused a good deal of comment. As it happens, the design is unfortunately reminiscent of an early 20th century political ideology that caused deep distress in Europe with its unflinching totalitarian ambitions. And we're reminded that the divided line between totalitarian politics and religion can be a very fuzzy one. Perhaps because, despite all the secular propaganda of the last century or so, we recognise that human beings have a default religiosity that can't be shaken off and will make itself known and felt consciously and sometimes unconsciously. Justin Brierley has been the host of a fascinating programme that Premier Radio ran for many years called Unbelievable, in which the voices of atheists in particular and Christians were placed together to allow for conversation. And as host, he observed in his recent book that one of the most significant shifts recently has been from the antagonism expressed by secular atheists against Christianity to a new antagonism expressed by the woke. An analysis of this might lead us to observe that whilst for some time the atheists were content to deny the importance and the existence of underlying meaning in a human quest, this had the effect of creating a vacuum of meaning in our culture that the woke are determined to fill. And this requires a repudiation and a defeat of the church and of Christian vision. Fresh from writing his new book, I asked Justin to share his sense of this new competition for meaning that this presents the church with. And he joins me now. Justin, you and I have met occasionally on the internet, but it's very nice to meet you personally now and to have this time to talk to you, especially after reading your very interesting book. However, because the church lives in bubbles, different bubbles of denominations and spiritualities and clubs and preferences, not everyone who's listening to us is going to allow their jaws to drop with admiration when I say you're the host of Unbelievable. People will say, "What's Unbelievable?" Now, there are circles where to say you're talking to the host of Unbelievable is to get immediate and high-grade kudos. But just in case any of our listeners aren't amongst that group, can you please explain what you've been doing for the last 15 years?
Yes. For over 15 years, I have hosted The Unbelievable Show, which has tried to bring Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. Very much began in the heyday of new atheism, so a lot of our early shows were responding to those kinds of arguments. And we've been privileged to bring on a number of the architects of that particular movement over the years for good discussions and debates with Christian thinkers and philosophers, apologists and so on. And then we've branched out into all kinds of other sort of subjects and so on over the years. What many people won't know, perhaps even yourself, Gavin, is that I actually recently moved on from The Unbelievable Show. So I'm no longer presenting the show. Only a couple of months ago that was. But it was a bittersweet goodbye because we really had developed an international audience through the podcast, through the videos, through the conferences. I wrote a book, of course, a few years ago with my case for faith after, at that point, 10 years of presenting the show. But the time had come for me to move on to some fresh projects, including the book that we're going to be talking about today. I'm now engaged in some interesting new podcasts and things, including one called Reenchanting, which is comes from the Centre for Cultural Witness for the Anglican Church at Lambeth Palace Library. It's been a wonderful journey. And of course, you have featured at least a couple of times, I'm sure, on the show itself over the years. But that's where we are today.
Well, one of the reasons I didn't ask you is because when someone moves on, you never quite know where the impetus lies. So I'm glad you've told me about it, because it suggests the impetus was at the very least mutual. But more than just a matter of personal development, which it obviously is, there are implications, aren't there, in terms of the project you've been doing. We're going to talk about that project and the book that you've written, which is a very, very good read. And I've so enjoyed reading it. And thank you for writing it and making it available. So the project was essentially evangelism and apologetics. Mm. When I was a university chaplain, I used to run a group once a week called Skeptics Anonymous. And it was a kind of embryonic attempt to do in a rather more amateur way what you've done so successfully at Unbelievable, which is to make a space for people of opposing views to come in and to put their cases about God, whether they believed or not, in an atmosphere where it was possible at least to unravel what they think they meant. Because as Peterson so famously says, you really do need to talk out loud in order to allow the thinking process that you have, which is a matter of consciousness and unconsciousness, to find some kind of concrete expression. So what you've been doing is allowing people that thinking process and that concrete expression. Now, having done it for 15 years, it can't be that you ran out of interesting guests, because life throws up interesting guests. Has the project run out of impetus? Or, I mean, sometimes, of course, one needs a fresh voice. But I'm not asking in terms of your career, your competence, which are beyond critique, but much more the idea of apologetics, doing it in the way you did it in that case.
Not necessarily, though. I would say even the show itself sort of started to go in a slightly different direction to traditional apologetics, you know, in the last several years that I was hosting it, because the conversation, I think, in the public was changing. And whereas I think in those early years of the new atheism, when the God delusion was riding high in the bestseller charts and so on, the church did need to kind of go back to its Aquinas and everything else to sort of get something like an intellectual response to some of these basic questions about whether there's, you know, an intellectual case for the existence of God and so on. At the same time, I do feel like probably the conversation has moved on to the degree that actually people aren't so much asking those kinds of specific questions merely about the existence of God and whether we can trust the historical reliability of Christianity and so on. They've moved into more questions around whether religion is good for us, whether we can find meaning without God. And those are the questions that are much more being asked by the sort of set of secular thinkers who I think have by and large replaced now people like Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and so on in the public sphere. People like the aforementioned Jordan Peterson, perhaps, you know, Douglas Murray, Tom Holland, Ian McGilchrist, people who I think were never really part of the new atheism themselves, but certainly have sort of rejected its fairly shallow answers to questions of meaning and purpose, are not signed up Christians by any means, but seem to be very sympathetic to the fact that the new atheist threw the baby out with the bathwater in their critique of religion, and that actually we are all inherently religious. And so those have been the kinds of more nuanced conversations, probably more fruitful conversations that we were having in the last several years that I was hosting the show. And to that extent, I think you do need more than your traditional apologetics, because ultimately we aren't just brains on legs, are we? We are a mixture of all kinds of biases and an emotional part of ourselves, psychology and everything else. And for me, apologetics rarely by itself in the purely intellectual sort of more abstract realm brings people to a knowledge of God. It's always a combination of that plus a spiritual, emotional, imaginative journey that people have to go on. And so for me, that's partly what I want to continue doing, you know, beyond The Unbelievable Show. I think there's a real case for, well, re-enchanting, really, the world with the story of Christianity.
So let's get back to re-enchanting. But you've said something very interesting that I haven't heard somebody say before. And so I'd like to tease it out a little bit, because I think it's to do with working out where the church is in relationship to the culture. And what you said was that you and I in our adult lives have experienced a watershed. And what we've just come out of is, if you like, the problem child of the Protestant Reformation, which produced this scientism that Dawkins ends up as being the poster boy for. And essentially what it's doing is it's entirely misunderstanding what religion is. It's the how, why thing. You know, we are the how people, you are the why people, and we how people don't need to know why, because we're too busy doing how well. And anyway, we don't respect the need for a why. Which, of course, was a very serious category error, because if ever there is a culture which is trying to deal with existential angst and discover the why, ours has begun it. So to hear you say that stopped is very interesting, because the church has been taking hammer blows from Darwin onwards about its so-called scientific illiteracy, delivered by a culture that was metaphysically illiterate and didn't understand what the church was doing. Now, we've moved from that into something different, which I'd like you to try and give a name to or describe if possible. Now what we have is, as you rightly say, we've got Tom Holland and Jordan Peterson, effectively public agnostics, if we take their own self-declaration, saying we've discovered in Christianity something very important and we can't find anything better for it. And given our disciplines and our preferences, it's very interesting and it needs paying attention to. So you and I are picking these people up and saying, hooray. We may not be doing apologetics anymore. Mm. We're certainly doing evangelism. But what you're saying, and can you flesh this out a bit, is that the cultural itch has moved away from Dawkins and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse to something else. And what I'd like us to try and do is to describe, if we can, what that something else is. It's got to do with cultural Marxism as being the one proposed solution to it. It's clearly got to do with the level of existential angst that's off the scale. How would you describe what we've moved into this side of the watershed?
I think, in a word, we've moved into something that some people, like the psychologist John Vervaeke, are calling the meaning crisis. There's a sense in which we as a culture are alienated from ourselves as human beings. We're certainly alienated from God. And a lot of those figures are pointing out the fact that we are inherently religious. We are inherently story-driven, meaning-seeking creatures. And that I think the problem is that the new atheists, in their zeal for science and rationalism, sort of pulled the rug, or finished the job, in a sense, of pulling the rug out of from under our feet in terms of having a story to live by, because they told us, well, you are essentially, ultimately, a meaningless collocation of atoms in a meaningless universe. And try as they might, try to sort of, sweeten that pill with some kind of, humanistic whatever, people ultimately know when they're being told that they're essentially just a random product of material processes. And I think this has all contributed to, in my view, this meaning crisis that lots of people tell us we're going through. It's been accelerated by technology. It's been accelerated by the culture wars. It's been accelerated by the fact that, in the absence of a story to live by, people are picking up all kinds of other individualistic stories, be it the progressive left stories of identity and so on, or the right, far right stories of a sort of nationalistic politics and everything else. There's a sense in which, when you take away one form of religion, people just replace it with another. And for me, that's, I think, where the energy has gone, in a sense, the conversation has gone. So the new atheism itself, to some extent, I think, is a something of a passé movement at this point. I do tell in detail in the first chapter of the book the way in which it essentially started to fracture and then kind of collapse in on itself, because once the key architects of the movement had agreed that God didn't exist and religion was bad for you, it turned out they could hardly agree on anything else, because some people wanted to take it off in a very social justice, sort of woke direction. Others wanted to be this free thinking oasis, and they all got into a massive scrap and could no longer share a stage with each other or do anything. And so it all sort of fizzled out almost as quickly as it had started. What's, I think, interesting about that is that the ones we still hear from, people like Sam Harris and others, they're no longer talking about religion, let's be honest. They've gone full front into the culture wars and those sorts of issues that are the current thing. So in a way, it was the culture wars that finished off New Atheism as a sort of significant cultural movement, in my view. And it's the culture wars which continue to define the kinds of questions now that the church needs to concern itself with. It's not that there aren't some of those questions still floating around about, you know, the intellectual case for God and Christianity and so on, but it is far more about identity and meaning and purpose and finding a story to live by. Those seem to be the kinds of issues that people ultimately are looking for answers to. And it's why people like Jordan Peterson have had such enormous popularity in platforms, because they're actually answering the kinds of questions that essentially, you know, Dawkins and Harris and co. failed to answer in their particular way of doing it. So for me, it feels like, yes, this whole energy has moved on to these new secular thinkers. The questions are asking, whether the answers are any good is another question, but I think they're the ones scratching the itch, as it were, of the millennials and the Gen Zs and where they're currently standing.
That's very helpful. One of the things that I think isn't coming through into the public debate is the extent to which it's always been about religion, but it's never presented as being about religion by the enemies of Christianity. Because if they meet us on our strong ground, we've been doing this for a long time. It's a bit like there are only seven basic plots to all the novels. We've met them all already and answered them. And it seems to me that this is the three-card trick that our opponents play, is to say, well, we're not talking about religion, so we don't need you. So the atheists did it in the terms that there is no meaning, we don't need any why, it's all about empiricism. And it took us a while to hold them down and say, no, you're behaving just like religious people. And the way you describe them bifurcating, like a Protestant cult, is perfect. They did exactly what Protestantism has done. They just, once they'd lost their common enemy, for Protestants it was the Catholic Church, for the new atheists it was Christianity. They did what people always do, because they were bound together by what they hated, not by what they liked. But to bring us to where we are now, the difficulty I have with the culture wars is that it seems to me that the culture wars have morphed into a conflict between different beliefs and faith. The pride flag is the emblem of a new religion. The way in which people are invited to sign up to progressive values seems to me to be identical to the kind of dynamics we find in religion and religious belief. But they keep on telling us it isn't that. They tell us it's equity or justice or culture or politics. And when we as the church come and say to them, can we please have a conversation about what you're really doing, because we think we have something to bring to the party, they say, no, we're not doing that. And you don't belong at the table any more than the scientists said we belong at the table. And I think one of the things that I think the church needs to do is to be much more confident in the way that it reassesses the competition for the human heart and mind and say, you're doing religion. Mm. And you're doing it badly. Where we do it badly, it's personal failure, not ideological incompetence. But you're doing it badly, both with personal failure and ideological incompetence. And that seems to me to be the kind of conversation that we need to have, not to do apologetics, but to put our case to heal the human heart and heal the human mind.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Gavin, because I think, as I said, we are inherently religious. And just because we perhaps abandon one form of the religious story, the Christian story, we are going to pick up something that is quasi-religious in nature. And exactly as you said, the sort of strict atheists, they have their version, you know, with their high priests, Dawkins, Hitchens, their sacred texts, the God delusion. They are prone to, you know, cancel those who disagree with their materialist orthodoxy, and they have their own heretics, people like Thomas Nagel, you know, when he came out saying, actually, I think there might be some sort of purpose in the universe. He was immediately persona non grata in those circles. But equally, as you say, it, you know, when it comes to the sort of more woke identitarian stuff, absolutely, they have their symbols, they have their rituals, they have their heretics. Think of J.K. Rowling. So it goes on, that propensity for that. But as you say, it's a very, sadly, in these circumstances, graceless form of religion. It has all the trappings of religiosity, but without any of the benefits, in a sense. And it's not just me saying this. This has been pointed out by many people. Douglas Murray actually has said this a number of times in some of his writings, that even as a non-Christian, as he calls himself a Christian atheist, he wrote in his book, The Madness of Crowds, about the way that the one thing he really wishes we could bring in from Christianity is the concept of grace and forgiveness, because it's so lacking in these public discussions and so on. So it feels like, yes, the people are still inherently religious, but they've got this, the worst aspects of religion. And you're absolutely right. I think the church stands at a really significant opportunity to remind people that your religious longings, they're coming from somewhere, but they're being channeled into essentially into idolatrous directions. That, you know, that's always been the case for humans, hasn't it? And that we're here to remind them that there is a good, true and beautiful story that makes sense of that well, ultimately good sense, you know, that often is behind this stuff, a sense of real justice and a sense that people want, that some things really are sacred and true and meaningful. But actually, when it gets channeled into these secondary issues, it always leaves people feeling burnt out and results, as we say, in the culture war. So it feels like the church is ready to stand up and say, look, we know what you're looking for, but you've been looking in the wrong place. Could we tell you a better story?
I can feel a rant coming on, and you may need to help me control the rant, or perhaps you can rant with me. The rant is this. So our new three exponents, our new three allies, Holland and Peterson and Douglas Murray. So Douglas Murray says, this new religion has no grace and forgiveness, and you're in real trouble without it. And Tom Holland says, this new religion entirely misunderstands the relationship with power and love. You've pinched the Christian version of love, but you don't know how to manage it, and you're soon going to resort to Nietzschean power. Watch out. And Jordan Peterson says, you pretend to have ethics, but you don't have any. All your ethics are cosmetic, and they're going to produce results antithetic to the standards you proclaim in public. So we have these three public intellectuals calling the bluff of the new religion and saying it's not incoherent, but it's dangerous and contradictory. Here comes a rant. Why aren't the Christian bishops, leaders, intellectuals, why do we have to turn to, I mean, I'm very pleased we turned to Maria Peterson and Holland. God bless them. Why is the church so mute, so lame, so inept? Why can't we produce this kind of, you know, you're self-accepted? Okay, perhaps we do have to turn to theologically competent lay voices, but I find it so frustrating that the people charged with defending the church in the public square and who've been equipped for it and given and accepted the responsibility for it, not only they're not doing it, but they're drinking the Kool-Aid at the same time. And they're trying to, they appear to be re-articulating the opponent's message dressed up in Christianity. What's going on here? Why the lack of confidence? Why the incompetence?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. I mean, I think probably primarily it's just very difficult to say things without getting torn down in popular culture these days. It is just the nature of social media that anything you say will be picked apart and raked over the coals. And you will, I think the church and church leaders who are sort of feel that they have a responsibility to sort of try to, you know, represent the church in some way, they are as much afraid of the council culture as anyone else. And they are also, many of them, trying to hold together very diverse churches in which there, you know, there are these different extremes. And so they end up saying, frankly, yeah, sometimes very mild and as inoffensive as possible things, but which actually, you know, everyone can safely ignore. This is what some of the people like Murray and Holland and others are pointing out. You know, when I talk to Tom Holland about what makes him most frustrated about the church, he says it's just not saying anything interesting. And you've got the most interesting story going, and yet you don't seem to be willing to kind of stand up and to talk about it as though it really is true. You know, as he often says, you know, please keep Christianity weird. That's another thing that Douglas Murray talks about. And many other similar people who are sort of somewhere on the fringes of maybe investigating or looking into it. Ben Sixsmith is another interesting journalist who's said very similar things, that he wishes, he's a sort of interested agnostic at this point, but he just wishes the church would sort of say things that are a little bit more countercultural, you know. But it is difficult to do that in our current culture. It's very difficult, and it's partly because, sadly, you know, for better or worse, the church is trying to market itself in the same way as everyone else, and that involves sort of trying to walk this very fine line between gospel truth and not upsetting anyone. Maybe it's time to abandon that because it's just, it doesn't appear to be producing the results people hope for, you know, when you look at national statistics. And to some extent seems to be putting some people off. But I fortunately don't have the same responsibilities that a Justin Welby or a Pope Francis or a whoever has in these sorts of circumstances. And I don't envy them those positions, because it is very difficult when you are essentially trying to hold together a complex and diverse church to actually call out some of the issues that inevitably exist.
So let me, in as gentle and as humble way as I can, say that I think you're half right and half mistaken. You're certainly half right when you say that any form of consumerism in the church leads to a degree of compromise and exacerbates the fear of being cancelled or not liked or not being successful. But to abuse my position for a moment, that's one of the reasons I became a Catholic, because that's not the Catholic position. The Catholic position is, this is the truth, this is the catechism, this is the magisterium. You become Catholic, we don't come to you. Ecumenism is coming back to the real church. It's not finding a solution with 1,000 Protestant denominations. And so Justin Welby does have that problem, but Pope Francis doesn't have the problem. Pope Francis is another conversation we had another day. But it does seem to me that once again, to abuse my position, that that's one of the great potential strengths of Catholicism, that dear Protestantism has lost, because Protestantism is at its heart a renewal movement. And its whole genius is trying to renew the Mother Church where the Mother Church went wrong. But 500 years later, the currents have changed and the dynamic has changed. And that's one of the reasons why I think that only the Catholic Church can save post-Christian civilization. But to do that, it's going to have to find the courage of its convictions.
I think you're probably onto something there, Gavin. And what's interesting to note is that a lot of the stories I do tell of those who have crossed the line to faith as adult converts in this book, they've either gone to Catholicism or the Eastern Orthodox Church. So arguably the two sort of, as it were, oldest traditions where, as you say, you don't get to sort of pick and choose too much what the way you want it to be. That tradition comes to you ready-made. And I think the reason why, and this was actually sparked by a conversation I was having with Douglas Murray in conversation with N.T. Wright. He remarked that when he does see some of his friends converting, they seem to be kind of drinking from the most ancient wells, as he put it. You know, they are converting to Catholicism or Eastern Orthodoxy because they want something stronger. They want something that feels different, and they don't want sort of, in his words, watered down Christianity. So I think there might be something there. I think to some extent, for people who are ultimately fed up with a sort of thin gruel of materialist, you know, scientism and so on and everything else, humanism, they're looking for something that has a strong historical pedigree, something that has stood the test of time, something that exists in a sort of other world to the postmodern world that we live in now. And for a lot of them, I think they are going back to those ancient roots. I stand somewhat conflicted here because I am a Protestant, as you know, and yet I have an awful lot of, I can understand the appeal, I see it in these people I interview, of those more ancient forms of Christian faith and why it does feel like a homecoming for so many people, as they've described it, when they do finally come back to Mother Church, as it were.
Well, thank you so much for dealing with the question in the very gracious way that you did. And I'll try and respond by not slipping to my club is better than anybody else's, because that's not the thing at all. But it strikes me it's all about teleology. There's a kind of Protestant instinct which has always been good and wholesome, which has been to say to the Mother Church, you've got to get back to Jesus. But the Jesus it gets back to is the difference between a photograph and a video. I've always felt that to really see what's going on in a situation, you can't have a photograph. Still photographs lie. Videos tell you much more what's going on. And the problem with the Protestant project was that it took its still photograph between sort of, I don't know, AD 30 and AD 65 or 69, just before the fall of Jerusalem. But the Catholics and the Orthodox have a video which goes from AD 33 to the 6th century. And so it's about teleology. Everything before Christ pointing to Christ and everything since Christ pointing back to Christ, but not in this artificial thin slice that Protestantism has taken out with the best of motives in order to get back to the Bible on the grounds that a hierarchy of values must put the Bible at the top of it. And then Catholics say, but, you know, we didn't have the Bible until the Council of Carthage, nearly five centuries. So please cut us some slack. Forgive it. So I think the people who are becoming Catholic and Orthodox are not changing tribes. They're not changing flavors. which I think is the Protestant instinctive reaction. Mm. You must have found someone who likes you better than we do, because you wouldn't be. But instead, shifting a worldview, and the worldview is really important, because what it's essentially doing is calling time on the Enlightenment idea of progress, and saying that what's happened from the 16th century to now isn't progress. I personally think that our Christian civilization may have peaked somewhere around about the 15th or 16th century. And in terms of ethics and values and architecture and music and philosophy and love for the poor, it's gone downhill ever since. It's an argument. It's clearly not a knockdown argument, but it's a point of view. But so in other words, I think that people becoming Catholic and Orthodox is actually the symptom of revisiting the notion of progress and the notion of time. And trying to understand the church in a way that isn't confined by our own self-understanding in the understanding of the West in the last 500 years. And if we're right, then Catholicism and Orthodoxy are going to have the muscle to deal with what's coming upon the church in its full Diocletian horror. and if we're wrong, well, it's just changing one club for another, and we're all cooked anyway, because there's no way of dealing with it. So for me, it does seem to be not about changing tribe, but changing philosophy and producing philosophy of hope, I think.
Yes. And again, I think you might be right. I think, as you say, it feels like something strong is needed to be able to weather the currents we're currently facing, but also to give something that is meaningful enough and interesting enough almost for those refugees from this meaning crisis to actually come and find a home in. Now, obviously, my hope is that I do think there are enough Protestants and traditions out there to potentially make a home for those who can't, for whatever reason, find their home in the Catholic or Orthodox traditions. But having said all that, another thing to note, I think, on top of all of that, is that to a large degree, I think some forms of Protestant tradition have inevitably, you know, become sort of analytical and doctrine driven in nature, to the extent that, going back to that sort of question about apologetics, it's become about constructing a sort of intellectual case for faith and that sort of thing. Whereas I think those who I've spoken to who have been drawn back to the Catholic and Eastern Orthodox tradition, yes, certainly there's a strong, you know, intellectual tradition in both of those. But at the same time, it hasn't tended to be simply some kind of good argument for God that's taken them there. It's been that they've entered into something that seems to be bigger than themselves. It's the mystery of the prayer and the liturgy and the sense of it answering something else deep inside them. Now, I would say that's not necessarily exclusive to the Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Church, in as much as if you go to a Pentecostal tradition, you might find something like that, a mysterious sort of wonder and awe that kind of draws you in. But having said all that, for most of the people I've been speaking to, it is that sort of sense of needing that fully orbed mystery and stream, if you like, to start to swim in, that's an important part of their conversion story as well.
I got in trouble with the president of the Latin Mass Society by trying to suggest that this was about transcendence and immanence. And being a philosophy don at Oxford, he picked me up and showed me that my arguments were really much too limited. And they're not, but they're really about numinousness, which is what you've been talking about. And so absolutely within Pentecostalism, we find the offer of the numinness, which I think mirrors both what you have in traditional Catholicism and most of Orthodoxy. The other thing you mentioned a few moments ago was you used the word weird. And when I was lecturing in the psychology of religion, one of my competitors used to try and introduce his students to pagan Anglo-Saxon magic. And the way of the weird was how he did it. Weird is, of course, the old Anglo-Saxon word for mystery, religion, spirituality. Now, this is a bridge to get you back to re-enchantment and the book that you're writing. So presumably, do you follow Rod Dreher? You know that he's doing something similar. Do you any sense? I suspect that you're both talking about the numinous again. And bearing in mind Tom Holland's advice to us was to keep Christianity weird, what's the project for your re-enchantment book?
Well, the book itself is called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And to that extent, it's looking at what has attracted, in my view, a number of interesting thinking adults back to Christian faith in recent years. And I'll, you know, one of the stories I major on is Paul Kingsnorth, who I'm sure you're familiar with. Again, one of these converts to Eastern Orthodoxy, interestingly. And he uses this term enchantment quite frequently, because he says he, although he had a sort of brief teenage atheist spell, he never believed the world was disenchanted. But he went on a very interesting winding journey to Orthodox Christianity, because he went via Zen Buddhism to Wicca, of all things. So a sort of mashup of sort of nature religion and some sort of modern, you know, versions of it. The reason he says that he went on this journey was because he was looking for something to worship. He felt that instinct to worship, and he thought, well, maybe it's found inside myself, maybe it's found in nature. Ultimately, though, he realized he needed something outside himself, something transcendent. And he found the answer to his search in the Christian faith. He was one of these very unlikely converts. You know, he was, if you'd asked him even just a few years ago, because it was a relatively recent thing, this conversion of his, he would have said, I was the last person. You would have knocked me down with a feather to say that I'm now a Orthodox Christian believer. And so that gives me hope, stories like that. And when I spoke to Rod Dreher on probably one of the last editions of The Unbelievable Show that I hosted, he was in conversation with Louise Perry, another interesting person who seems to be drawing near, let's say, to Christian orthodoxy, even as a secular person from a sort of feminist background, but who's come to surprisingly Christian conclusions about, you know, sexuality and relationships and so on. Well, Rod, you know, in that conversation, he described the fact that when you go into the average office, you don't bump into a lot of atheist materialists. What you tend to find is a mixture of people who are more likely to put on the survey spiritual but not religious, who have all kinds of interesting esoteric beliefs. They might describe themselves as pagan or as a witch or dabble in some kind of new age practice. Likely as not, they pray at some point, even if they describe themselves as non-religious. And you see it in the fact that supernatural horror films are still incredibly popular, that stories about witches and wizards still seem to capture people's imagination. The fact that the Catholic Church is inundated with requests for exorcism because there's been such an uptick in people dabbling in the occult and everything else. All this is simply to say that religious sort of urge for something outside ourselves hasn't gone away, and people will start looking for it in other places, often the wrong places. And to that extent, when Tom Holland and Douglas Murray and others say, keep Christianity weird, it's because people are attracted to that supernatural dimension of life. They know that the world is enchanted in some way. The question is, are they going to find the true and beautiful source of all that, which ultimately I think that the church can show them. But if we're going to do it, let's, for goodness sake, do it in a fully embodied, you know, as Holland says, talk about angels, for goodness sake. I want the angels, you know, if I'm going to be a Christian. And for me, I think that's something we need to hear. We've sometimes watered this message down so much. We've tried to make it so palatable that it becomes just another sort of bit of, you know, fluffy PR and just like everything else people have got in their lives already. So I think there's a real wisdom there from some of those people to say, yes, let's re-enchant. Let's give people what they actually really want deep down, which is the weirdness of the Christian claim about a God who came in person and who defeated sin, evil, and death itself, and rose victorious bodily, transformed, and says you can be part of a new world. I want to tell people about that, and yeah, if they call me weird, so be it.
On the back of what you're saying, we find ourselves being directed to those two great Catholic doctors of the church, if I may, Augustine and Chesterton. I mean, Chesterton saying, if you stop believing in God, you believe in everything. And what you've described is an instinctive spirituality that becomes superstition and believes in everything. And then Augustine, who tells us, Lord, you've made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find themselves in you. And so what we're dealing with is people's soul-embedded restlessness because they haven't found God. And I think probably what the church's task is to do is to try and explain to people what holiness is as opposed to unholiness. And I think my great criticism at the moment of contemporary Catholicism, if I'm allowed to have one from the inside, is that the people who are doing much of the attempt to throw bridges across to the culture are doing it in terms of the what kind of bridge they think the culture wants to have. But actually, the bridge, the only bridge we can construct, which again, we're very good at as Catholics, we have the whole language of the saints and the miraculous and of sanctity. We have bodies that weren't corrupt. We have human beings with the stigmata. We have miracles of sanctity. Again, my enthusiasm for Catholicism is unbridled. People are very well set to offer this experience of sanctity as opposed to unsanctity. I've just been listening to a dreadful Catholic bureaucrat providing a paper at the Vatican in which he uses all the language of progressive modernity, and it sounds like bureaucrat speak. But actually, what people are longing for, I think, is holiness. And once they experience holiness, and this is where the Orthodox are much better than the Catholics, and the Orthodox laity are really very, very astute at saying, we've got holiness amongst us, and we're jolly well going to recognize it for what it is. It has its own epistemological authenticity. And it seems to me that that's what's in the armory of the church at the moment, this capacity to live a life in the Holy Spirit with holiness, with all its recreative, re-sanctification, re-sanity, all its potential for re-envisioning human beings. What you're describing as weird is actually the life of the spirit. It's the life of the soul.
And for me, it's about calling people to a great adventure. And the problem is that so often the church lowers the bar so low. You won't have to change, you know, just a little bit of, you know, tweaking around the edges or something. And I think people don't see the great adventure, the call to heroism and discipleship and sacrifice and everything else, when we've kind of commodified Christianity into just another sort of option among many for sort of life enhancement. And no great Christian revivals or revolutions ever happened in those kinds of circumstances. So I think sometimes I think we have to be presented with a crisis in the church for people to stand up and start to say, okay, the bits and pieces we're doing around the edge aren't, you know, we're just moving the deck chairs on the Titanic at this point. Something different has to happen. And I think it's very instructive when you see from outside of the church, you know, some of those voices telling you, look, there's something about this story that attracts me, but the church itself isn't doing a great job of telling that story or inviting me into something that makes sense of that. And so when you've got the Petersons and the Hollands and the Murrays and the whoever else is saying, you know, look, the story of modernity is pallid and anemic, but please give me something full-bodied and meaty. And I think it's an invitation to the church to sort of, you know, do something different and to invite people into something that really does take commitment and bravery and you know, really means, yes, you may have to change the way you think and the way you act and everything else. Sometimes you have to get sort of to the point of desperation, though, where you realize that's the only thing that's going to move the needle in our culture, you know.
Well, I think we're there. I don't think there's any doubt of the fact that the church in the West has certainly reached a point of desperation. I mean, you remind me, of course, that that's how Tolkien and Lewis nailed it, by producing archetypal great adventures for people to go on that were a matter of life and death in order both to save themselves and to save their culture. Peterson, once again, keeps on reminding the church, just as you've said, don't lower the bar. Demand everything. We have generations of young men who are desperate to be given a proper a challenge to go on an adventure, a pilgrimage, a crusade, a journey of discovery, upon which everything might matter. Justin, thank you so much for joining this conversation. Your book is a very good read. It's a marvelous mixture between the anecdotal and the intellectual, and I love the way in which you weaved human journey through conceptual clarity. It's great.
Yes, well, it's available to pre-order right away, the new book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, and it always helps if people do it via my website. The link's there. Get a little bit of extra for the author than just going straight to Amazon. So justinbriley.com is a good place to go to pre-order your copy.
If it's half as good as your 15 plus years at Unbelievable, it will make a huge impact for the church and the kingdom. Thank you for everything you do.
Well, thank you so much, Gavin, and God bless you for all that you're doing in similar endeavours.